You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The average American produces just over 7 pounds of trash a day, and that adds up to 102 tons across a lifetime. We throw away so much stuff that trash has become a geographic feature. Plastic particles are transforming our oceans, and there's a landfill in California that's so large it's visible from space. There's $50 billion of waste rotting away right now, and it's the subject of Edward Humes' latest book called Garbology, which is published by Avery. I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Humes to our show today. Hello.
Good morning. Afternoon, actually, now.
Yeah, well, you're from California, so it's still morning. The idea of a garbage crisis isn't exactly new. Throughout history, haven't people just hurled their trash out the window?
Yeah, that's actually New York City was particularly notorious for, being kind of knee-deep in some parts of town with, this would be at the turn of the last century.
How did they deal with it?
Well, they used pigs. They had scavengers, and, the people with money would hire a young street urchin to sweep ahead of them.
So they would bring pigs in to just eat the trash? That lasted a long time, didn't it?
Yeah, actually, Charles Dickens wrote about that. Beware the pigs. And there was also a more organized effort to actually have piggeries and haul the garbage to them and feed them and then bring the pigs to market. And that practice endured up until the 50s and 60s in various parts of the country.
Well, were people aware of the fact that trash brought other kinds of problems, like vermin and disease?
Oh, absolutely, and that's why that practice has throughout human history sort of been the subject of all kinds of thinking and changes. You know, the ancient Greeks invented the original anti-littering law and municipal dump. You know, a mile out of town, you had to haul your waste there, which in the pre-motor vehicle era was no small feat for them, and that was a big innovation. We really haven't progressed that much past that particular innovation since then in terms of how Americans deal with trash.
Well, in New York, Colonel Waring was brought in to deal with the mess of New York City trash. Was his approach effective?
He was a trash visionary. In fact, Teddy Roosevelt turned down the job. He was a second choice for
police commissioner instead, a very unpopular police commissioner, because he tried to clean up the city in another way.
Yeah, and he figured that might be a better springboard to higher office, which I guess it was. But Colonel Waring had this idea of cleaning up the streets first of all, and he had this several thousand white-clad army of street cleaners come and do that. But the White Wings, they were called. There's some really great video of those available on YouTube. Check out White Wings sometimes. But the second part of his solution was to repurpose a lot of the waste, and what wasn't going to a dump would be reclaimed. They made this product called garbage grease, which is exactly what you imagine it might be, used in various products, and leather and metal and wood were reclaimed. Of course, one of the main components of waste in that era, 100-some years ago, was coal ash. That was the biggest component of our trash. Obviously, it's changed a lot since then.
Well, in The Great Gatsby, F. Scott Fitzgerald writes about the Valley of Ashes, where he describes something that's a fantastic farm where ashes grow like wheat. What was that? What he was describing?
That was the Corona dump. Yeah, it was massive mounds of coal ash that were brought out there, I think at one point by electric train or trolley. And that, of course, now you can go watch the Mets there or attend the National Tennis Center or both the 1939 and 1964 World's Fair.
So it's Flushing Meadow Park.
Yes.
It was covered by sod and grass?
Yeah, they buried hauled away. Since there was a mountain of coal ash there, I believe some of it had to be hauled away and dumped elsewhere, and then the rest was covered over and landscaped. There's still, as I understand it, some the artificial lakes out there have some contamination problems left over from those halcyon days of the Corona dump.
Well, is it toxic through the grass as well?
I don't know the answer to that.
Because there must be heavy metals down there and all sorts of toxins.
Yeah, I think it's probably pretty much sealed in That would have been the practice.
But people have been concerned about making landfills into parks. It's often
Wall Street's on a landfill.
that's ancient old Greek. I mean, old Dutch ships and stuff like that. It's a little different, but. There have been all sorts of places where they've just – in Staten Island, for example, where they've suggested you just put some grass over it and everything's going to be okay. Let the kids play on it.
Yeah, there have been problems at the early days of reclaiming landfills for housing developments in the 50s and 60s, fires, methane escaping, and other contaminations. A Love Canal, for instance, is sort of the epitome of what can go wrong when you – don't do it right.
Some methods of waste removal may seem strange to us now, but they were actually quite popular until about 30 or 40 years ago. For example, backyard incinerators, which were a huge contributor to pollution, particularly in Los Angeles in the 1950s. People just burnt their trash in the back of their homes?
Yes, yeah. There was a whole industry of creating these backyard smiley face home-friendly incinerators for burning trash. Of course, New York had its own version of that, the apartment incinerators. And you know, we think of smog in California as being primarily from automobiles, but even before car culture took off in the post-war era, the incinerators were a major contributor towards smog there.
So bans were imposed. And
yeah, it was a big
battle. Been really effective?
People didn't want to give up their incinerators. Well, that left landfilling as the major alternative. So it's that creates a different set of challenges and problems.
What about those piggeries that you mentioned earlier? Were they those pigs later butchered? And
They were. It was a way of feeding your pork in a very your future pork in a very economical way. And I remember, I grew up in Philadelphia. I remember. In the 60s, the practice was still underway. We'd have to separate our food waste, put it in these little pails out in back of the house, and they'd come and take it for the of course, the piggery was in New Jersey, but you know that's the idea was that we could repurpose and use that waste.
Well, you have to wonder how safe that was to eat.
Well, by that time, they had started sterilizing the garbage to avoid spreading disease, which was a big problem with that practice.
My guest is Edward Humes, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Monkey Girl and Eco Barons. His latest book is Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash. You describe America's economy of abundance as being a huge reason for our trash production. What fuels America's overconsumption, and how bad are we compared to the rest of the world?
Well, we are, of the developed nations, the per capita waste leaders. I mean, the Japanese generate about 2.5 pounds per person of trash per day, and we're at 7.1 pounds per person per day. European nations are more in the 3 and 4 pound range by and large. And these countries rely much less on landfills. They recycle much more. You have waste energy plants, and our go-to solution has been the landfill.
Some people are composting more now than they did in the past,
yeah.
But that's just probably just a teeny portion of the problem.
Well, actually, it's a big problem. I mean, about 15% of what goes to landfills is food waste, and that's shrunken over the years somewhat because more composting is being done, not as much by consumers so much as other sectors of the economy.
Are Americans worse about throwing away things before they wear out?
Yes. Yeah. Actually, it's fascinating studying the history of this. And there's this fellow, he's the father of corporate branding. J. Gordon Lippincott was his name. And he kind of had the marching vision for the post-World War II economy of abundance that you mentioned, this idea that we'll never run out of things and we should act accordingly. And I'll just read the quote. It's fascinating. This is what he said. Our willingness to part with something before it is completely worn out is a phenomenon noticeable in no other society in history. It is soundly based on our economy of abundance. It must be further nurtured, even though it runs contrary to one of the oldest inbred laws of humanity, the law of thrift.
But then we had the Great Depression, and
well,
we had all the shortages of World War II. Did we learn anything from that?
Well, that was the era of thrift. It was the era where we dare not waste anything because we were either too poor or democracy was under siege and there was no room for waste. This vision of abundance came after, and it has owned our economy ever since.
A listener in Crown Heights writes, a couple of months ago I heard a recycling expert on WNYC say that personal residential garbage accounts for just 2 to 3% of the total of what's in landfills in the United States. The rest is industrial waste. Is that an accurate number?
Well, municipal waste is only one portion of our total waste picture. I mean, if you count what we flush and industrial waste, and it's a much bigger picture. Of course, our consumer choices also drive the industrial waste because it's primarily to service us that that waste is made. But, for instance, the landfill Garbage Mountain in Los Angeles, about a third of it is residential municipal waste. A third of it was, until the recession, construction and building. And then the other third is various assorted sources, so commercial perhaps.
So with the slowdown in construction, the landfill isn't growing as fast as it did?
No, but the municipal waste component has stayed fairly constant. So it's much more than that percentage in terms of what's going to landfills. But the total, I mean, if you look at the total amount of waste made on behalf of each one of us, then we're getting into the millions of pounds.
Well, you report that municipal waste was only 0.4% plastic by weight in 1960. By the year 2000, American households were throwing away 63 times as much plastic as in 1960. So what happened? Is it just plastic packaging and plastic bags that we take things home from the grocery store?
Basically, yeah. I mean, we've become the disposable nation because plastic was originally the miracle material that was going to be incredibly durable and replace things like ivory in piano keys and billiard balls. And we had these wonderful artistic objects, those Art Deco radios and phones that were made out of plastic and that lasted forever. That was the new miracle substance.
But so nobody saw its pollution possibilities?
It was only when the disposable aspects of plastic products came online later that the plastic forks and spoons and plates, containers and packaging, which is primarily paper and plastic, is now 25% of what lands in landfills. It's not even getting recycled. And these instant trash objects, I mean, as soon as we get them, they're trash. We throw them away. Are made of a material that endures for hundreds of thousands of years.
So we send them into the landfills. Other things decompose and the plastic remains?
The plastic remains. Or it doesn't make it into the landfill and ends up in the ocean, where it doesn't decompose in the conventional sense, but does break up into smaller particles that then enters the food chain.
Have we seen a little bit of a reversal now that more people are bringing their own bags to shops and cities like San Francisco have banned plastic bags?
Yeah, well, communities that have looked at either fees or bans on disposable bags, both plastic and paper, have seen an uptick in the use of reusable bags. And, then that, just like disposable plastic displaced most paper, now we have reusable displacing plastic in some communities. It's different winners and losers in the economy, but it's still an interesting evolution. It has opportunities for some people to build on.
What about the things that are sold as biodegradable?
Sometimes that is a real boon because it enables us to compost things that we couldn't in the past. But a lot of these compostable, like chip bags and all, it turns out you need really special facilities that most communities don't have to cause them to biodegrade. So they end up not being it ends up being more PR than anything else, and they land in the landfill and stay there.
My guest is Edward Humes, H-U-M-E-S. His latest book is Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash. It is published by, who did I say it was published by? Oh, Avery. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. By the way, this book is probably biodegradable, isn't it?
Indeed.
But not the
only
not
after
the
you
cover.
Read it.
The cover has some plastic in it, I think. We're back with Edward Humes, who's the author of 11 nonfiction books, including Force of Nature, Monkey Girl, Over Here, School of Dreams, No Matter How Loud I Shout, the bestseller Mississippi Mud, also the winner of a Pulitzer Prize. His latest book is called Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash. It's published by Avery. A listener asks, how safe are modern landfills? Is methane capture to create power a good thing, and is it being done?
Well, landfill, we now call them sanitary landfills, the technology has definitely improved, and a well-run landfill will have many safeguards, plastic barriers, test wells and all to keep things from seeping out where they shouldn't seep, because all landfills eventually leak. I think they've tried to control that aspect of it, some better than others. And then there's the emissions from landfills, methane being a principal product of decomposition. Some of that can be captured to make energy, which is better, a better-than-nothing solution, not a very efficient way to make energy, but better than just bleeding it off or flaring it off. But even with that capture, one of the shockers to me was that the science suggests that the greenhouse gas emissions from landfills is actually greater than a modern waste-to-energy plant that burns trash. Several times greater.
You would think that it would be more ecologically efficient, but it's not. In the case of Puente Hills, which we talked about, the largest municipal dump in the country with 130 million tons of garbage, does it have an effect on the environment?
Absolutely. And I should say it's the largest active. Fresh Kills in New York holds the distinction of being the largest anywhere. But
in L.A., you got a lot more garbage just being made by the film industry. So.
Yeah, indeed. Well, they do capture quite a bit of the methane at Puente Hills in L.A. Enough energy from all that amassed trash that they can power the equivalent of 70,000 homes with it, which is...
It's going to close in 2013, so where's the trash going to go now?
Well, the plan has been, and this was a plan that was created before the recession, was to put it on trains and haul it out into the deep desert to a retired gold mine. Unfortunately, that raises the price per ton from... Under $20, which is what the fee was at the time at Puente Hills, to over $80, which nobody probably is going to want to pay these days. And so it's unclear exactly where all the trash is going to go.
Well, is our landfill still the best approach? What are some of the alternatives?
Well, we know that a great deal of material going into landfills now, perhaps a majority, is actually recyclable or compostable. Even though we're not doing it. So other countries are finding ways to divert that trash. And some communities here in the U.S., I mean, in San Francisco is diverting 3/4 of its waste now away from landfills.
Well, when he first tried to stop recycling, our current mayor, Mayor Bloomberg, said that it was costing the city more than it was worth.
Well, New York's been kind of a laggard on its recycling program. It's way behind other cities, although I think they're trying to turn that around.
Well, we do recycle now. I have separate trash cans in front of my house, although there are people who report that then the garbage truck comes and they throw them all in the same thing.
Well, unfortunately, what we put in the recycling bin isn't always recycled because for a variety of reasons. Contamination, if you don't rinse out your recyclables, then it's called contamination and the recyclers don't want it. But this material has value. And depending on the type of material, it can have a lot of value. I mean, people are getting rich off of recycling materials. And it can be very cost effective when it's done right and done efficiently.
You spoke to David Steiner, the CEO of Waste Management, the world's largest and possibly most notorious trash company. Where does Steiner see the future of trash going?
Well, you know, he hired a consultant a few years ago who very seriously said, you know, you need to start thinking of your company as materials management, not waste management. He laughed and said, there's always going to be landfills. And well, he still says there's always going to be landfills, but he does want to be materials management now. He may not change the company's name, but they are investing in new startup technology that the hope is it will allow them to reclaim some of the value they're locking away in their landfills. This is the biggest trash company in the world, and they control almost half the landfills in the United States now. He says, I get $10 billion of value a year dumped in those landfills in terms of material that if we had the tech to do it cost effectively, I could pay you for your trash and still make a lot of money out of it, and that would be a very interesting future.
Well, but the problem actually begins right at the source. Stephanie from Brooklyn writes, I work in a building that doesn't recycle anything. We throw away paper, glass, and aluminum. The building's landlords say that because they're not required to by the city, they don't want to spend the money separating and recycling trash. Why doesn't the city have tougher recycling standards?
Well, that's a question for Mayor Bloomberg, I suppose. The communities that have provided incentives for recycling and disincentives for being wasteful have turned that around. I mean, it's the simple shift that you see in some places like Portland, where you are charged by the amount of trash you make. If you ask for a smaller trash barrel, you pay less. What's wrong with that? That should be the way it is. Why should the people who are less wasteful subsidize those who are more wasteful? That model makes a big difference.
Well, you have you write of one family, the Johnson family, that went from living in a sprawling home in the San Francisco Bay Area suburbs to a much smaller home in a place that's closer to the city and doesn't require a car. And they really took going green seriously. They thought they were green before, but now they are perhaps the most green family in America.
Yeah, indeed. And it did start with a downsize. They had to move into a house half the size. And suddenly, well, do we really need three sets of china? And do we need the extra couch? And, well, there's no room for it. Let's get rid of it. And that led to a rethinking. If you take away everything they recycle and compost, their annual trash fits in a mason jar. It sounds almost inconceivable, but they buy in bulk. Bea Johnson, who's really the driver behind this zero waste effort, brings mason jars to the store. They weigh them. Then she gets her deli meat or her cereal or whatever it is she's buying in bulk, put into the jars. They weigh it again. They charge her just like it was wrapped in layers of plastic and paper. And she has incorporated that kind of practice throughout their daily lives.
Although isn't she shifting some of the trash to the supermarket rather than to her home?
Well, no. They don't have to use the packaging that otherwise they would use.
Well, that's great if they don't sell things in boxes and jars and cans.
Well, but she goes to markets that have bulk offerings for that.
She also makes her family's soap, deodorant, toothpaste, household cleaner, limits her wardrobe to a set number of items. Some people might consider that a bit extreme.
Sounds crazy, doesn't it? Well, that's what I said. You must spend all your time doing this. She just shakes her head and says, you say I make my own cleaner. I buy Castile soap. I buy vinegar. Those are my two cleaners. I save so much money. I don't have 12 different bottles of window cleaner, tile cleaner, grout, cleanser. These much more natural products work just as well, and they're pennies versus dollars. So she saves money. She saves time.
And when she is asked, what difference can one person make, what does she say?
You know, not everything that she's willing to do is right for everyone, but some things that she's doing, anyone can do. And that's kind of her message. You know, it's very easy to refuse wasteful things. You know, you don't need that tchotchke they give away free when you're walking down the street. You can put a stop to those catalogs that all you do is throw away. You don't have to use 500 plastic bags a year, which is what the average person does. And changing that is a very simple throwing of the switch in a different direction. So she says anybody can do some of this.
And communities can do it. As we point out, San Francisco has banned plastic bags. In Maine, they charge 5 or 10 cents if you use a plastic bag in a supermarket.
L.A. County just did that. It's so hilarious. You go to Trader Joe's now, and people don't want to pay that dime. You see them, I forgot my bag, and they have like their cans coming out of their arms and running out to the car, leaking food and picking it up. It changes behavior, even though who can't afford a dime?
Edward Humes is here. His latest book, Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash, published by Avery. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In 2009, MIT scientists embarked on a journey to follow trash to see where it really ends up after it's thrown away or recycled. How did they go about creating this smart trash that could be tracked?
Oh, this is sort of this vision. What if everything could talk and report its position to you? We'd have a waste-free world because everything could be directed to exactly where it should be. So this is sort of a science fiction-y vision, and they decided to try it out. And they took the guts of cell phones and attached them to people's trash. They got volunteers in the city of Seattle was the main place they did it and a few others, but this was the main effort. And then had them throw it away, just as they would anything else, or put it into recycling and see where it went. Because we know all about our supply chain. We know almost nothing about our removal chain, as they call it. And the results were shocking. I mean, they have this great display. It looks like a NORAD display of incoming missiles, except what it is outgoing trash going across the country. A printer cartridge from a computer printer that somebody put in a recycling bin crossed the country twice back and forth before it finally found some place where it could be recycled.
But it was just passed on from one dumping?
It was shipped from west to east and then back again and then back again until it landed at a place that said, yes, we can recycle that. And the problem with that is it removes all the benefits of recycling and puts this enormous carbon footprint and energy expenditure on the piece of trash. And they kept seeing this. Not for everything. Some places, you know, the trash went right where it went. Other times you have a pair of old sneakers that like ran multiple marathons before it got where it needed to be. Or a coffee cup that took a week to make it to the landfill.
On the other hand, a lot of old clothing winds up going to third world countries where they are repurposed.
And e-waste too, yeah.
And I'm not. And then we create waste in those countries.
Yes, where it's not always dealt with in a way that would be environmentally and legally acceptable here.
A listener wants to know why styrofoam still exists.
Because it never goes away. That is the substance that lasts forever, even though it's disposable.
Well, part of our country's mounting trash problem is that you say Americans are delusional about what they actually throw away. Delusional?
We're like addicts. I mean, we've made a disposable economy where it's somehow been correlated with prosperity. The more waste we make, the more prosperous we must be. You can actually measure it. But we, you know, nope. There's been studies of this. In fact, I read about the original garbologist, Bill Rathje, said, you know, we do surveys and people tell us how much alcohol they drink, and then we look at their trash and they, ha-ha, you know, way much more waste related to that. And
are they lying or simply not realizing how they're living
their
lives?
They're not lying purposely. It's not conscious. It's because we don't have no idea that if you could collect all your trash for a year on your front lawn, it would be 1.3 tons on average for the average American. Then you'd see. And you'd also see, if you looked at all your trash for a year, how much of what you pay for ends up being trashed so quickly. Even things that are supposedly durable aren't very durable because we fixate on the cost at the cash register, whereas other consumers in other countries tend to think about the cost of ownership, which changes the horizon and the materials you buy.
Lotta from New Jersey asks, despite what we hear from some politicians, doesn't change have to come from the top down to make a real difference?
I think it has to be both, grassroots and top down. You know, we accept a lot of waste embedded in our daily lives without doing anything about it. I mean, look, junk mail is my favorite example of this. 1 out of 100 pounds going to a landfill, not recycling, landfill, is junk mail, which is by definition recyclable, but it's not happening.
Hasn't it been cut down?
85 billion pieces.
By email?
85 billion pieces of junk mail were shipped in 2011 in the U.S. It is more than 50% of our mail. And in fact, that proportion goes up because other kinds of mail. And we're subsidizing it. Not only are we dealing with it in our homes, unwanted junk coming into our homes, but we give such a low rate compared to first-class postage for it. We're footing the bill for stuff we don't want. It's crazy.
And the post office is in trouble, and Congress is balking at giving it any more money. They really have to do is raise the rates for junk mail?
Well, I don't see why. I mean, I don't see. Do our listeners want junk mail? I mean,
The next thing you know, they're going to raise the rates for millionaires on taxes. it's a slippery slope.
No kidding. Well,
we've spent a lot of time on the show talking about the plastic in the oceans, so I don't want to dwell on it, but it is one of the major problems right now, and it's in all of the oceans, isn't it? Is there any way to get rid of that stuff? Couldn't somebody just take big nets and the same sort of thing that they've been catching tuna with and capture a lot of plastic?
No, if only. You know, first the scale of the problem. The example I use is by weight, it's like losing 40 super aircraft carriers a year at sea in terms of the weight of plastic entering the ocean. This is just the trash we lose track of. And it's not that. If only it were big hunks of garbage floating around like in a landfill, maybe we could do something about it. And there is that type of refuse, and there is some cleanup efforts being done. The main problem is this chowder of tiny particles of plastic that we're finding throughout the ocean that you see washed up on beaches, and that fish are ingesting very low in the food chain. It's plankton-sized plastic. And it's confused with plankton by these small organisms that then enter the food chain and move up to the point where it gets into the seafood that we rely upon.
And does it really have an effect on human health?
We don't know, because the ocean is also has a certain level of toxic compounds that get dumped in it and spilled into it that is essentially insoluble in water. So when it comes across little plastic particles, it says, I can stick to you now. And then there's a concentrating effect. If small organisms eat a little bit of that, and then larger organisms, many of those small organisms, suddenly you have large amounts of toxics accumulating in the food chain. That's the concern.
Is there any positive side to this story?
Yeah, of course there is. This is the one big social and environmental problem anybody really can do something about. You don't have to be as wasteful as we are, and there's very good strategies for doing that that also save you money. Even if you don't care about the environment, you probably care about your household budget. You know, the Johnson family that we were discussing before that has really tried to be zero waste, they've cut 40% of their household spending. So their college funds are looking good. They go on cool vacations. They say they don't give each other things anymore for birthdays. They give experiences. You know, they find ways to give each other things to do for the day, trips and that sort of thing. And that's their philosophy, and it works for them. And it's less wasteful.
Edward Humes, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Monkey Girl and Eco Barons. His latest is Garbology, Our Dirty Love Affair with Trash. It's published by Avery. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.